This is an RNZ podcast.
No mai, whakarongo mai ki te Aotai Whenua. Welcome to Country Life. I'm Sally Round.
Great to have your company. I'm Duncan Smith. Today, reconditioned tractors from New Zealand are helping Tongan farmers recover from last year's devastating eruption.
We meet an aeroplane pilot who stays grounded by putting his hands in the soil, harvesting lavender.
And later on, a dairy farmer is bridging the cultural gap on his riverside land.
First, though, to our look at the week's agricultural news. And RNZ rural reporter Sally Murphy's joining us from Ototahi Christchurch. An interesting story this week, Sally, around New Zealand's sheep population.
Kia ora, that's right. The ratio of sheep to people dropped below 5-1 for the first time in 170 years. A spokesperson for StatsNZ's Agricultural Production Census, Jason Atterwell, says as of June last year, there were 25.3 million sheep.
I get asked this all the time as a statistician from New Zealand, is how many sheep per person? And for the first time in 2022, that ratio dropped below 5 sheep for every person in New Zealand. So, and in 1982, way back then, there were 22 sheep for every person in New Zealand.
So what's behind the drop?
Well, Beef and Lamb New Zealand says innovation in the sector means farmers are getting better results and returns from fewer sheep. Chief Executive Sam McIver told me there's been remarkable changes in the last 30 years.
There's been a major efficiency gains. Our lambing percentage has gone from 100 to 130%. And our average carcass weight in terms of lambs processed has gone up from about 14 to 19 kilograms carcass weight. And what that is a reflection of is just a massive lift in efficiency. So we need less ewe numbers now to produce the same number of lambs as we did sort of 30-odd years ago.
Sam McIver says farming sheep is very profitable, but they do require a lot of labour. So some farmers have switched to farming cattle. He says that, alongside farmland being converted into forestry, is also behind the drop in sheep numbers.
Now, a pretty big blow for New Zealand's Mānuka honey industry this week.
Yes, the Intellectual Property Office of New Zealand ruled the Mānuka Honey Appellation Society can't trademark the term Mānuka honey.
Yes, and it's been an 8-year-long battle for New Zealand, hasn't it? This latest ruling was after an appeal by the Australian Mānuka Honey Association, and they argue their honey's also entitled to use the word Mānuka.
Yes, the association's chair, Dr. Ben McKee, told me the industry across the Tasman is obviously very relieved.
It's good because there is not a precedent of this trademark going through. Hopefully it'll get our friends in New Zealand to put down the guns, and we can, with the work together now that it's been lost in their own country of origin, hopefully they can rethink the strategy and work closer with us on marketing Mānuka. I mean, we're not a threat to your industry. We're not that big, and hopefully we can work closer together.
The Intellectual Property Office awarded costs of $6,400 to the Australian Mānuka Honey Association. Ben McKee says that's pennies compared with what they've spent, but he says the decision has made it worth it.
And the honey industry here must be pretty disappointed.
Yes, the Mānuka Charitable Trust is, but it says it's undeterred by the ruling. Chair Peter Tipini says the group remains resolute in protecting reo Māori, and if anything, the decision has made it more determined to protect the honey, which it considers a taonga.
The law itself is an ass, and it is not keeping in step with where, in fact, global politics and global trade is going, and the example is the free trade agreement between our government and the European Union, where Mānuka is a Māori word and Mānuka honey now has a separate tariff line, recognising the inherent distinctiveness of Mānuka as a taonga species.
Peter Tipini says the trust will take some time to absorb the ruling before considering its next steps. It has 20 working days to appeal the decision to the High Court.
And another dismal milk price forecast from Fonterra this week.
That's right. The dairy company has trimmed its milk price forecast for this season and announced an even lower forecast price for the next. The new midpoint for this season is 10 cents lower at $8.20 a kilogram of milk solids. Fonterra says global dairy trade prices have not recovered as predicted and demand from China remains soft.
Now let's have a look at some news in the fishing industry. Labour issues set to ease a bit.
That's the hope. SeaLord has 115 new workers from Vietnam arriving in the coming weeks to work at its factory in Nelson. The company was short 200 workers during the busy hoki season last year, and that cost them millions. But with the cap on visas for on-land processing lifted to 600, the company says it'll be a relief to have a full staff this winter. Chief Executive Doug Paulin says the staff will arrive in time to get training before the boats head out to fish at the start of June.
At this stage, get the people into the factory, get them used to dealing with hoki, train them up, so when the vessels start landing a lot of quota, they're ready to go.
And Doug Paulin says the new workers from Vietnam will work with 80 Samoan workers who joined the company earlier this year.
And Sally, great news for Hawke's Bay, particularly after Cyclone Gabrielle. It's been named a Great Wine Capital of the World.
Yeah, this is big news for the region. It made the list alongside 11 other global heavyweights such as Bordeaux, Verona and Napa Valley. The accolade takes into account the quality of the wine and the experience on offer to visitors. Hawke's Bay Wine Growers Executive Officer Brent Lynn says making the list is a great boost for the region's growers.
Hawke's Bay has always placed itself as one of the great wine regions of the world, and this is really validation of that claim when we sitting alongside some of our peers at that table.
Must be a bit of a boost, eh? Especially for growers still cleaning up after the cyclone.
Yes, it's an extremely welcome tonic for the industry. They've come through an incredibly difficult period with Cyclone Gabrielle, and it's great to get people's heads up and looking forward to the future while still being recognising that the road to recovery for some others is a little bit longer.
Brent Lynn says some vineyards are still in recovery mode following the cyclone, but most are open for business and ready to welcome visitors.
Now, wool growers have brought up some concerns about new rules around pain relief for sheep.
That's right. The New Zealand Merino Company is requiring its growers to use pain relief for castration, tailing and any severe shearing injuries on farm from June 2025. It warns growers will need to adapt or risk losing their premium position in the market, as pain mitigation is quickly becoming a non-negotiable for some markets. Federated Farmers Meat and Wool Chair Toby Williams says wool growers wholly support animal welfare, but rules should be developed by the industry.
The concerns we have are that animal welfare regulations in this country should be developed industry-wide as opposed to on an ad hoc basis by individual companies. We've got no particular issues, but we need to do it via the industry-wide discussions. And, you know, it makes sure we've got appropriate timeframes to ensure that the availability of product and the technology for delivering it is there, and that we've got adequate training given to the people who are going to be administering it.
And Toby Williams says supply of the anaesthetic will need to be secured first.
All of New Zealand's only turned to do this year. We're going to need about 22,000 litres of lidocaine, of pain relief. You need about 1 mil per sheep, and there's 22 million lambs docked annually, roughly. So that's a huge amount of product. We're not even sure that you'd be available to get that to the worldwide supply.
And that's Toby Williams from Federated Farmers.
Thanks, Sally. That was Sally Murphy from Ototahi Christchurch of our rural news team.
This is Country Life on RNZ National 101 FM. If you've got an old Massey Ferguson tractor sitting in your paddock, our guest this week would like to hear from you. Farmers in Tonga could do with them because ash from the huge volcanic eruption just over a year ago still needs tilling into the soil. Peter Rodwell is chair of the Pacifica Safe Shelter Trust, and he's working with a local charity to help subsistence farmers in Tonga. Sally put in a call to him in Oamaru.
Ash itself, volcanic ash, is actually quite rich in elements, but if you lay it on top of the ground, it completely smothers it and takes out the current crop. So all the leaf vegetables at that stage were basically destroyed. the root crops could be harvested at the stage they were then at because they had lost their leaf on top. So if they weren't ready, they lost the crop completely. If they were ready, they could harvest them over the next sort of 6 to 8 weeks. That was fine. But then there's a gap until they can plant the next crop. And to plant the next crop, you have to till the ash in and just mix it back with the soil. It's not toxic as such, but it needs to be mixed with the soil so they can get growth from the plant.
And these tractors that you're sending, they're not the sort of sophisticated computerized tractors, are they? Those aren't the tractors that you want to send.
They need vehicles, equipment that can be relatively easily fixed and diagnosed as to what the problem is. We have been sending particularly Massey Ferguson's and to some extent Ford's because about 80% of the tractors over there are Massey Ferguson's and about 19% are Ford's and about 1% are everything else. They have found with all the new tractors sent over, the new Chinese tractors, which look great and big and all the rest of it, they're breaking down and they can't fix them because they're all computerised and there's no computer fixes over there. There's a lot of new tractors sitting in the ditch on the side of the road.
Yeah, so the simpler the better, Peter.
It is. So we're sending the, basically they have to be non-electronic. So it's basic mechanics and the Massey Ferguson's are ideal in the sense that they have lots of spare parts because getting spare parts over there is also expensive.
Is there training needed?
There is, because one of the difficulties is one is there is not that many tractors, so that not that many tractor drivers that are skilled at ploughing and particularly ploughing in fields that have a lot of trees in them. And there's a lot of pressure for the men in the Pacific to go overseas and work on these programs in New Zealand, Australia. And large numbers have in fact travelled because they're financially struggling. So there has been a real push to get their young men out overseas to earn money to send the money back. But that leaves the women behind, and not very many women are skilled at tractor driving. So one of the tasks that our in-partner charity has taken on is actually training women in agriculture from where to go, from how to tend the land, because it's mainly women now tending the land. And secondly, they're now running tractor driving lessons, ploughing lessons, to actually get the women up to level.
And what are some of the other stories you're hearing about how the tractors are being used there?
Because it's very small blocks and you have to have the average farmer can't drive the tractor, they get the tractor in for when it comes through their area. They get the tractor for an hour or 2 hours each time it comes through, and that's probably once or twice a year for that farm. So one needs to have an organisation which provides the tractor, does the maintenance on the tractor, provides the fuel and the driver for the tractor. So the organisation we're working with is setting that up so that there's a coordinated centre that they can contact and book their tractor in. In the past, the difficulty has been a limited number of tractors, and the people who get the tractors are the big landholders, the lords, and they control the tractors, and if they want the tractor, they get it first. So the poor people end up missing out. So we have made a general rule that the poor people get it first. The people who can't afford the tractor get it first. And if you can't afford the tractor at the going rate of 120 paying an hour, then you miss out. But on our score is if you can't afford 120, then you pay 100. If you can't afford 100, you pay 80. If you can't afford 80, you pay 60. And if you can't afford 60, you get it for free. And if you can't afford 60, then you get it first, because these are the people who are the most in need.
So if you've got a tractor in your paddock, you should perhaps think about donating it.
Many of these tractors have been holding down the end of an irrigation line. They're used as an anchor. But they've been driven out there. Most of them are in moderate working order and don't take too much to bring it back up. But yes, we would love to hear from people if they have particularly a Massey Ferguson in the 1 or 200 series. They're the classic tractors that we're after. And some of the Fords and Majors, we're quite happy to take those as well.
Peter Rodwell of the Pacifica Safe Shelter Trust. He says they're also keen for disc ploughs and slasher mowers to send to Tonga in the next shipment.
to the outskirts of Cambridge now, where an aeroplane pilot has swapped the city life for a taste of rural living. With a spare acre or two wrapping around the house, Damien Payne got to thinking what he could do with it. But it didn't take him long to put his hands in the soil, cultivating pops of purple for all to enjoy. Leah Tebbutt joined him one morning for an aromatic journey through the lavender fields.
Acre Farm is just plucked out of the head, really. and we ended up with essentially that main field is about an acre. We got about 1,700 plants altogether.
So when you moved in, did you have the idea that you were going to build a lavender farm around it?
No, absolutely not. It was we moved here for the family and the kids and everything else, and then it was a case of what are we going to do next? The neighbour asked me if I wanted to keep the cows on the property, and I said no. And then he saw me mowing the grass and thought I was mad being a farmer. And then it was a case of what do we want to do with the property and what can we do? We figured we'd try something different and kind of landed on lavender being one of them. So then we started getting into it pretty quickly. We kind of arrived in October and I think I was playing paddocks in January or something like that.
For goodness sake. Have you had any horticulture experience prior to that?
No, not really. But we looked at lavender partly around how it grew, how much work was involved around what other things we had going on in the life, so to speak, and it seemed to be the right thing to do for us. And we just wanted to enjoy it primarily. There was no pressure to make sure that it was going to sustain us commercially right from the get-go. So worst case, I can sit in the lavender field and drink the gin, really, if it all went sideways.
So we've just walked across the front of the house to one of the first lavender fields.
Yeah, well, there's some future stuff around the back. This is the main field. There's about 1,500 plants in here, split into three varieties. Each row that you can see here is about 110, 120 metres long, hedged more like a hedge as opposed to individual plants. And that's really just how I've chosen to prune it up. But this time of the year, it's the quieter time for us. I've pruned it back sort of by the end of March, and you can see just a little bit of green growth coming on. The lavender pruned this way and with that little bit of growth will go into winter. It'll basically become dormant and then be ready to go in October when it bursts into life. We've got three varieties in the field here, so basically three rows of each variety. We decided to try three different varieties because they're a little bit different, each one, and you can use them for different things. The highest yielding oil variety is the middle rose. That's the Grosso, so that is the one we generally save for cutting at the end of the season for taking away to do oil extraction out of that one. And Super on the far side there, very similar, slightly less oil, but a nice tall stem. So one of the bigger challenges this year was weeds, like everywhere in the country. I think with all the rain and warmth, weeds were terrible, but I've managed to get them back under control now. Having everything pruned back, you can see pretty well the different varieties. So this is the Super here. It's got a lot more autumn growth on it, nice and green.
These are such a different colour to the ones we were just standing on before. They're not green, but they're more like a bluish green over that side, and these are vibrant green, eh?
That real strong green is the new growth since I pruned it back. So I pruned it back to basically the wood of the plant, because it will, if I leave it too big, we'll get quite woody and not have that good growth for next year.
Right.
So I was a little more conservative this year. That's not pruned back quite as hard. Originally in here in this paddock, it was just a paddock. There was stockyards across the top of the lavender rows here and just grass. There was really one paddock here and one that we're walking along and one on the back. This driveway, the north side of the lavender field, we put in to get to the accommodation at the top here.
Oh wow, so you do sort of boutique accommodation?
Yeah, we refurbished that just last year, and it's just something else that we can add to what we do.
So what do you do in your other time?
In my other time?
Your spare time, but this is almost your spare time, yeah, isn't it?
There's not too much spare time. Probably the most of the spare time's with the kids, and they've got plenty of sport, and that's part of the reason we came to the country life, and is to give them the opportunity to keep being kids.
So you don't miss Auckland?
No. And there's no right or wrong answer. We didn't cash up out of Auckland and make millions of money to come down here. It was just a lifestyle choice for the family. And Cambridge hit the mark. I'm an airline pilot.
Are you really?
Yeah, most people, if I roll up in my fluoro top and my work boots, don't generally pick that one. Kate's also a celebrant, so that's another part of the equation going on. And that's what I mean. It all kind of just fits. I'm never going to retire doing this, but eventually that's what that structure at the top of the lavender. So there's some frames and posts in there that will one day be a chapel. I've got most of the timber for it. It's time and finishing, but I drove to Christchurch and picked up the church doors from the original church where the cardboard cathedral is now.
Yeah.
So I've got two sets of the 3.1 metre high church doors. You'll see them in the shed, and a stained glass window from a church in St Albans.
How much are you harvesting at the moment with three varieties?
We take probably about 8 to 10 wool sacks of flowers away to harvest for oil, and that would be from 500 plants. So realistically, we don't take it all for oil, but if we did, it would be circa 24-25 wool sacks. Of that Grosso variety, which is about 500 plants and 8 to 10 wool sacks, we would get about 5 litres on a standard kind of year. So we'll do the Grosso 5 litres, we'd do some of the Super, which is another variety, and get sort of 3 or 4. So we end up with about 8 litres a year would be about standard for us, and that's enough to keep us going through the year with the other things that we make.
When you started the farm, did you have the concept of all the different things that you make?
No, it's all a voyage of discovery, really. You learn. You're always learning something, doesn't matter whether it's lavender or something else. So, like I said, I've got the best-smelling man shed in town, eh? Right, over there, that's the harvester sitting over there in the lean-to.
Should we have a look?
Yeah, sure, have a quick look over there. I built it's a 100-square-metre shed with a mezzanine in it. I've got a couple of lean-to sheds and a container. I still don't have enough room. there's a few things hiding under here, actually. This is the harvester here. So what is that? That's about a couple of metres long. It's like
a strange-looking contraption, eh?
Yeah, it's got two sort of large bicycle wheels at the front, a couple of small jockey wheels at the back, and sort of like a basket area. And on the front is the cutting harvester. So as I mentioned, it's essentially a hedge trimmer, but it's got the curved blade on it. And 500 plants, so a third of the front paddock, I can generally do in a morning, because that's the challenge with harvesting for oil, is I need to cut it. I need to cut it when it's dry. I can't cut it when it's wet.
Yeah.
And I need to get it to Auckland that day.
Oh,
and
really?
We need to put it through the still, preferably that day. This beast here is the rubbing machine. This is like a small workbench size, so it's at about a metre square and about a metre high. It's got a little electric motor there, which I plug in, and a box with a big, if you had a look around the corner there, I think I equated it to one of the brushes that you clean your boots on. Basically, that big brush spins and you poke a bunch of dried lavender in underneath it, and it just rubs through the stalks and just brushes off the lavender heads, and I put a bucket at the bottom and
collect all the flowers.
Yeah, it's way easier than hand rubbing.
So we're just walking up now into the best smelling man shed in Cambridge.
Yeah, so in here, obviously in the roof's probably the first thing that people notice. You've got some wires strung between the rafters, and that's where we hang the lavender to dry.
So here's the workbench. You've got bottles and stickers and lids and all sorts of bits and pieces, hey?
A little bit of everything. So I got things that I need to make what we want to make. On the table here is, there's some oil here. So I've got three different bottles of oil. So this is a 1 litre, just amber bottle of oil. So straight from the still, straight to the glass bottle, straight into the customer's small bottle.
But you've also got surface sprays here, hand soap. Am I missing? Oh, you've got your moisturiser and your hand sanitiser.
We'll do probably a few other things. You can see a couple of... Yeah, I'm always buying a different jar or looking at how I can package or do something differently. And it just, like I said, depends what you're into. Some people want to do lip balms and other things, but having 15 products gets complex.
You're going to spread yourself, all your oil that you've harvested across a few different things.
And you end up with 15 different types of labels you've got to get made, and so you try to standardise some things, like the bottles are the same. And that's where that diversity piece comes in. You can choose to be in the marketplace however you like. Some are products that you make using oil, and then the clear one there, so that's a 200ml clear bottle that has hydrosol in it. So when I talked about the distillation and the steam going through and condensing that, you get the water and the oil. Well, the water is hydrosol, but it's picked up all those botanicals of all the stalks and everything, but it's not oil. So it's quite a different fragrance, I don't know.
Oh yeah.
So it's not lavender.
It has, you can tell that stalkiness. I know what you're saying. It smells more like the plant versus your normal lavender oil.
Yeah, and I could, some people call it a lavender pillow spray, and some people try and make it smell more lavendery, but then you're adding things to it. I call it an infusion spray because I can't think of anything else. It's good for a smelly dog or your bathroom where it won't stain because it's not oil-based. So that's another straight product of the still. We've been lucky enough to get a couple of silver awards over the years.
Yeah.
And I think we got a silver for this one as well. Always kind of happy with that.
It's rewarding, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's just the growers are always keen to have a crack and see what everyone else thinks about their oil. That's what I mean by different oils, by different growers, distilled different ways. They come out different. But even over time, the oil qualities can change and the fragrance can change. So you don't throw it out even if it smells really bad or what you think is bad. You keep it and you might let it air a bit or keep it in the cupboard and come back to it 5 years later and you're like, hey, actually, that smells pretty good now.
My nose has changed.
And different varieties will have a different fragrance. We've just got Grosso here. I've got plenty of Super and a bit of Pacific Blue in the cupboard. But generally we sell the Grosso.
Is that pure oil?
Yeah, I could sell pure oil from all of those varieties, but this is the one variety we sell that's kind of our go-to oil. I'm pretty particular about the Grosso, and it is our sort of our, not best oil, but it's the one that we like the most.
Damien Payne there of Acre Farm.
Tēnā rā koutou katoa. Ko whakarongo mai a koutou. Ki te reo irirangi o Aotearoa, ki te country life. Tēnā rā koutou tō katoa.
Now we're heading to Mouse Point near Culverton in North Canterbury. Cosmo's there with farmer John Faulkner and Makareni Rupini from Environment Canterbury. With Makareni's support, John is restoring the biodiversity along his riverside land for Mahinga Kai, a place valued for its natural resources where kai can be gathered.
We're on my dairy support block, which is on the south bank of the Waiaufa River. And I've got a dairy farm a kilometre up the road as well. And the two properties are integrated together. I milk the cows on the dairy platform, which is 162 hectares. And then over the winter period, which is May, June, July, and a little bit of August, the cows come down onto the support block and do their winter grazing here. And we've got 47 hectares on this area, but only 35 are effective. There's about 12 that are in river protection. So restoration plantings, and the river's got about another 7 of that.
Mm. And where are we going to now, John?
We're heading down towards the restoration site, and there is a number of parts to it, and the first part is what I call the parkland area, because I wanted to do a restoration site based on cultural values and traditional Māori usage around Mahinga Kai, the Nohanga site. And the Nohanga concept was explained to me by Makarini and a few other Ngātahu representatives. And it was part of the traditional gathering of Mahinga Kai. And there was a resting area where the tribe would camp for a period of time. And there's not many of those sites that are functional in Canterbury anymore. So I thought, well, I've got the land, I've got the area that would be suitable to perhaps develop a contemporary Nohanga site. So I've taken that action.
Mm. We are here with Makarini as well. Makarini, can you tell me a bit about yourself and what you do?
Kia ora. I work for Environment Canterbury as a paumātai core, a cultural land management advisor. So I go out on farm and just like John here and talk with farmers, explain to them cultural values. What is Mahinga Kai? Why is it important? And how to protect those cultural values. And this sort of dates back to 1840, obviously with the signing of the treaty, and part of that was to hold on to the natural resources and assets, forestry and fisheries, and what come with those was Mahinga Kai. Then again, I jumped to 1848, where the New Zealand Company purchased here in Canterbury 22 million acres from the local tribe Ngāi, and under that sales agreement was for 10% to be put into reserves, hospitals, schools, access to Mahinga Kai and undisturbed flow of fresh water for our people, our whānau of that time. When that purchase deal was done, which unfortunately wasn't honoured, there was £2,000 paid, but there was no schools, no hospitals. And out of that 10% of that 22 million acre land block, less than 1% was put into reserves. And it became apparent to the whānaus that through fences going up and private land sales, access to Mahinga Kai and our cultural way of life was being eroded or impacted on. So for me, I try to explain to landowners and community groups, industry groups, what is Mahinga Kai? And that brings in the concept of mātauraka, the knowledge, and living and breathing that knowledge, and with that connecting to Mahinga Kai, understanding what's around us and how everything interconnects in the natural world.
It's a lot more than just food.
That's correct.
And how did you meet John?
Met John through one of the zone committees. John was sitting in there as a farmer and a land user, and I was sitting there as a Ngāi Tuahuriri Rūnanga whānau mana whenua representative, and that's how John and I met.
And John, the rest is history.
Basically is. About 15 years have gone in the blink of an eye.
Yeah. Well, shall we head across the paddock and find out what you've been doing?
Yep, we will.
Well, first of all, my boots.
Yeah.
Part of what I wanted to do with the restoration site was to incorporate family, because if you think about the cultural experience that Makarini's talking about with Mahinga Kai, it's not an isolated person going out and doing some fishing or doing some eeling or anything like that. In the traditional concept, it was the whole family, the children, the young people, everybody. So I've set it up so that we have a parkland area.
We are in that area now, aren't we?
Yeah, so it's just set up for kids to explore. They can have a bit of fun, they can run around, they can play, but the parents can still sort of see them from a distance.
And going back, what made you really interested in doing this Mahinga Kai journey? there a story?
Yeah, there is a story. I was born and bred in Morrinsville, and every name around the area, it was Kirioni, Narua, Patitonga, Hoeotanui, Motumaho, Kuranui, Waharoa. They're all Māori names. And right beside our farm, there was a Mangatapu hill, and that was the site of an old Māori pā. And quite often I'd sit up there and I'd think about the old folk that would have lived there. And then I was fortunate in having a history teacher that taught us probably a more modern version of New Zealand's history. And we also had two marae, Kaia Tamata, which was only about 5 kilometres from where we lived. And then we had Rukamawana Marae, and that was the seat of the first Māori Parliament and one of the key parts of the Māori King movement. So you had all that involvement, and you had Māori at school, and the cultural values resonated with me. And I had a very good friend, Vince Leonard. He was a tahonga whakaero, a master carver, and he had a huge influence on my spirit, and he still does. And then going into the zone committee process, or the Canterbury Water Management Strategy and the collaborative process, and listening to people like Makarini and others there that were representing Ngā Tahu, I got to the point where I thought, well, enough talking. I've got the land. I know what needs to be done or attempted to be done, and I'll give it a crack myself.
Makarini, I guess what John's talking about is what you'd like lots of other farmers to tap into as well.
Yeah, that's right. And interesting enough, you know, a lot of farmers and landowners on their farms, they have that one little special place that, you know, for us we say Māori has that life force, that specialness, and they feel it. And that's a place that some farmers like to go and you know, they be them, be there.
Is that place right here for you, John?
Yeah, it is. And one of the joys that I get out of farming is I come down here and I'm working with my stock, but I've got all this beautiful regeneration going on around me, and you can feel it. It's what Makarini talks about. It's the Māori. Mm. You can feel it, and it's got a something about it that just calms the soul.
Talking about calming the soul, from where we're standing on this plateau, we can see the river glistening through the bushes in the early morning light.
Yeah, and if we move around a bit further, you'll get a better view of just a magical piece of New Zealand, the Waiaupa. And that's the other part of the reason that I wanted to do what I'm doing, is this stretch of the river between Twin Bridges and Waia Township is one of the 7 braided river plains. And it's just a weed choked mess at the moment, and I want to try and encourage people to get in and remediate it and return it to what it used to be, so that the endangered species, the wybrel, the banded dotterel, etc., have got nesting sites. So there's a huge amount of work to do here. It's not just about the restoration of the riparian margins or integration with farming. It's the whole holistic approach of the mountains to the sea concept that we were talking about in the zone committees.
Well, let's carry on and see what's happening closer to the hour.
Now, this sort of area I was going to have is little campsites for people just to camp or do something here.
What a stunning spot. John, tell me about what you've planted here overlooking the river.
Well, where we are at the moment is what I call the contemporary-based Nohonga site, and we're standing in the camping area. And we're at the rear, we've got a series of plants, a lot of kanuka, manuka there, and some totara plants at the top end, or the western end of there. We've got a lot of flaxes and cabbage trees, etc. And there's approximately 64 to 70 species rongoā Māori plants here. And I engaged a lady, Sue McCaw. She's a native plant specialist, and she did a lot of study on Rongoa Māori plants. So she's been responsible for putting the plants in the selection, and they all are endemic from a 5 kilometre radius, so they were here in the past. And there were a few other plants that shouldn't have been here, and they've been taken out and replaced. But of that 64 plus plants, some of them are quite intensive growers and they'll grow very large, and other of them are very fine sort of ground cover plants that if you walked on them without knowing what they were, you wouldn't even recognise them.
So what John has actually done, he's actually keeping the whakapapa, or the genealogy of all these plant species, mahinga kai, alive. Like he said, it's been sourced locally, so it hasn't been brought in, so it still has that relationship to what originally was here, which is very special.
But what I'm also trying to do is to have my Noanga site, so to speak, as a basis of a spoken hub system in the future, whereas more mahinga kai sites get developed in the area, there may be more wetlands or whatever other sites there are available. This can still be used as a base for the camping, and then you can go out and do some harvesting and come back and you sit around a fire, you have a beer, you tell stories like you used to and like we do now. And it's just to have that experience in the nature though.
So are you saying that you want to turn this area here into a public access mahinga kai site?
Exactly, that's a long-term aim.
That's pretty special, isn't it, Makarini?
It is, and this is brilliant, having someone with the commitment and the vision to have a project of this scale. If we could get more landowners and industry groups supporting this, our environmental minister pushing for this throughout all of New Zealand, it has a follow-on effect which creates a healthier environment for everyone, from our drinking water through to breathing our clean green air. Mm.
And John said you've brought some children here, some school kids.
Yeah, we working in with John and wanting to show the community what the good work that John's done, one of the local schools was really keen to come out, and at the same time we got them to become an enviro school, so part of that is them really stepping up and looking at the environment and how best to utilise what's there. So it was a great way to showcase to them everything that's been done out here, the different native plants, some of their uses, as well as gathering kai from the awa, the river.
They must have loved that.
Oh, they did. It was fantastic just to see them all squealing and smiling and, trying to pick up an eel. It was brilliant. Mm. And that's part of the whole process, because we've had probably 30 or 40 different people in here that have just absolutely loved being involved with this. And there were probably 4 or 5 that had Māori heritage, and it was great to see how it had invigorated them into doing a bit of exploration about their whakapapa and their history.
And Makarini, in terms of a cultural divide, there's still a bridge to cross?
Yeah, there is. There really is. I sort of really feel we haven't got to where we should be, hence why the work I do around holding mahinga kai shared talks with landowners, farmers, industry groups, really trying to educate them around the past history, the promises, the laws that are still in place, these regulations that haven't been upheld, which have had major impacts to the Māori culture and our way of life. But just to try and educate and show them that actually it's nothing to be scared of, and by having a better understanding, you can get the realisation that it's in everyone's best interest to have a connection to mahinga kai.
Yeah, I'd like to add something there, because I know there's a lot of issues out there at the moment that, from a Pākehā perspective and the Treaty of Waitangi that raise a lot of concerns with people. And I've gone back and I think about my relationships with Māori friends over the years, and I have to say that if I didn't do something to try and progress mahinga kai or relationship with Māori, then I would be severely disrespecting any of the friends that I've had. And yes, at times I get concerned about, okay, where's this all going? What's going to happen? But that is a fear-based reaction. And I've always said that I'm not going to live my life in fear of doing something.
The path beside the river winds its way through all the plants that John has planted, and in the distance we can see some dairy cows.
yeah, just behind the toi toi.
You planted thousands of plants. Did you get funding? I'm guessing it would have cost quite a bit to do this.
Back in 2018, we had the idea and started planting a few plants myself. And then there was the Billion Trees Fund applied to that for 2.5 hectares of intensive native restoration, received 50,000 grant and put that into the project. And then also there was an in-kind contribution of 25,000 as well. And that has been more than doubled. It's not a cheap exercise to do something like this.
No. And that's where I like to come in and talk and work with the farmers, and then we can look at putting a, if they're really keen and interested in doing a project, we'll bring the team in and we'll do a plan and look at what funding's available to make it easier on them to have some great outcomes on farm.
So you can help farmers achieve those goals.
That's right.
Yes.
Yeah. Yep.
It's a lot stonier here, John. We must be closer to the riverbank.
We're very close to the river. It's only about 20 metres away, and there's a bank in front of us that is part of the river protection. But all around here, the plants just on the left-hand side, they're 2 years old, and they're at the stage now where they're almost fully canopied over the weeds, so the weed maintenance is no longer as intensive. And as we go around further for the next 500 odd metres, we've got nodes of plants that have been put in specifically so there's walkways around. So when we get to the point where we can open it up to the community, there's dedicated pathways for people to come in and have a look. And there'll be areas where you can sit and relax and just enjoy or bring something into camp.
As we look around, the work that John is, we're starting to walk into now, is unbelievable. This is like looking at a countdown of the old time, because to the unknown eye, you're just looking at a whole lot of native plants. But each species has its own use, from anything from medicinal to cleansing, fragrance, cooking, eating, weaving, as well as tools. Everything's here. If you know what's there, you know how to utilise it and use it.
John, you've got your support block right here on the other side of the fence. Have you had to change the way you manage the farm to accommodate this new idea, this new direction?
Not completely, no. It's always been part and parcel of how I've been trying to farm. It means that I've given up a bit of land that could have been productive, but really I think the gains in the opposite direction are more than outweighed.
Yes. So what is the next step for this large area of land by the river that you're transforming?
I've got a hopeful plan that I can transform this area from a winter grazing property to just a feed support property. And I've got a vision that, and I'm quite excited about the concept of a composting barn. So if I had a composting barn on my dairy farm, and I wouldn't need to have dairy cattle winter grazing on this block here. So that's what I would love to do over the winter period for 3 months. And they're on a bed of compost which generates heat, so they're in a warm environment.
Yep.
And it's one of those problems that dairy farming has, especially in Canterbury and Southland and in the more environmentally challenged areas. Winter grazing is an issue, and it's not just an environmental issue, it's an animal welfare issue, and I'm seeking an answer. And I see a composting barn as being a potential answer.
So I'm just climbing up a wee stony ridge, and we can see the river now, and it's winding its way gently through the landscape.
Yeah, we've got a slight bit of a fresh coming through at the moment. And how far to the other side, John?
Oh, it could be 2 kilometres.
Yeah. Oh, smell the rain hitting the warm shingle. Gives you that smell, doesn't it? Beautiful.
I'm glad that we've just been able to turn on a real North Canterbury finale for you.
Nice, yeah. And I just want to say, we have a whakatauki here in Te Wai Panamu, the South Island. We have a kaitahu whakatauki. Mō tātou ka muri, a uri aki nei for us, our children and their future after us.
Makarini Rupini from Environment Canterbury. Cosmo was also talking to Culverton dairy farmer John Faulkner.
Now, to see photos from this story and all our stories this week, go to our webpage, rnz.co.nz/countrylife. We love getting your feedback too. Email us at country@rnz.co.nz.
Well, that's all we've got time for. Have a great weekend, folks. Bye now.
Ka kite.